It is for veterans experiencing mental health and substance use challenges, a respite home managed by fellow veterans. We're talking about the R&R House on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Health Services says it is the first of its kind in the nation, opening earlier this year in Pewaukee. The need is urgent. Among veterans with recent care by the Veterans Health Administration who died by suicide in 2018, nearly 60% had a mental health or substance use disorder diagnosis in the lead-up. That's according to the VA's 2020 Veteran Suicide Prevention Report. Are you a veteran? Where do you see gaps in services? How are you assisting a fellow veteran? What do you think of a respite home? 800-642-1234. Brian Michael is Director of Prevention Services at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. He's Program Director for R&R House. Brian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. We also have Peter Boricki, who is house manager of R&R House, which is operated by Mental Health America of Wisconsin. Peter, welcome to you.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me be here.
Peter, you served in the Army as an infantry soldier. You received a Purple Heart in your Afghanistan tour. First of all, thank you for your service. What was that transition like from military to civilian?
Getting out of the military can be pretty tough, just because when you're out, you're essentially out. And especially for me, when I was getting out of the military, they didn't really tell you how to go about getting your benefits, who to talk to, who to reach out to. So you're kind of on your own. So it's a little hard at first trying to figure out who you should be contacting for help. Disability or just someone to talk to. And for me, it was a little difficult too, because I really just didn't know who to talk to, because, you know, back home is my family or my civilian friends. And for me, it was really difficult to talk about my experiences with them, since, you know, one, they weren't in the military, and two, try and talk to a civilian who's never been in the military, it's hard to communicate. You know, us veterans essentially have our own language. Mm-hmm. So when you're trying to tell your story or, you know, something that happened, it almost seems like you have to stop and pause every couple minutes to explain something, which can be pretty frustrating.
Oh, I would imagine. So what happened? How did you find your way? And where did you find those, you know, breakthrough moments where you could really get connection?
So for me, it was a lot of trying to do research on my own, which led me to good places and bad places, but then really reaching out to other vets that I know, like either through American Legion or people I served with who are getting out too. And eventually, you know, I did find a really good counselor who was able to connect with me, and that helped a lot because he was also a veteran.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Just having that other person was a veteran helped me out a ton.
Brian, how do you view what the state is offering as far as mental health support, and where are the gaps?
So I think it's difficult because the system that veterans are asked to navigate is extremely complicated. It's extremely complex. Like Peter said, many of them don't know which door to go to first. And for which issues, there's a lot of difficulty in navigating those waters. So that's right off the bat. Veterans that are transitioning out need that support to know where to go and where they can get support. Obviously, the VA is a wonderful resource, but not every veteran wants to go to the VA. They might have had a bad experience with it. There's sometimes stigma associated with seeking mental health care, which is a stigma shared by the general community, but even stronger among veterans. So there are opportunities for to get that support, but it's just a matter of finding it sometimes. But there, that be at the VA Medical Center, the vet centers, the Milwaukee Vet Center, or other vet centers around the state that are there to support veterans who are in combat. Otherwise, it's really left up to the community resources and for them to work with a private provider who, like Peter said, often don't have that military background. So they're not able to really make that language connection, that cultural connection to make sure that they're actually being heard when they're getting services.
We're talking with Brian Michael, and he is program director at the R&R House, a new home in Pewaukee that's for veterans experiencing mental health and substance use challenges. Peter Borecki is with us, house manager, and sharing his story in the Army and becoming into civilian life. You can join in with your insights, 800-642-1234. Brian, to help veterans find the support they need, you helped open the R&R House in Pewaukee. Can you give us a bit of a tour? Tell us about it.
Sure. So the R&R House started from a grant that we received back in the beginning of 2019, a grant from Department of Health Services. And from then, it's a difficult undertaking to open a project like this. There's several other respites in the state, peer-run respites in the state, but this is the only one that focuses exclusively on serving veterans. The other ones don't accept veterans, but there's no special programming. There's no emphasis on making sure that they staff with veterans. So while they're a great resource, they're a fantastic resource around the state, they don't offer that specialized support that a veteran can get at the R&R House, where they can connect with another veteran who's been trained to use their own lived experience to help others in recovery. So it's really been a journey from getting the funding to getting the staffing, and then it's a matter of, you know, we had to bring all these people on staff and ask them to come on for a project that was still in development. And we were actually prepared to getting ready to open our doors last year in spring, and then we got hit like everybody else did with the coronavirus pandemic, and had to really make some adjustments on the fly. That's when we developed service member, veteran, and family warm line. So that's a non-crisis support line that's operated by our peers from the R&R House that provides 24/7 non-crisis support. So it's called a warm line rather than a hotline, mm-hmm. because it's there to provide people with just some of that, when they're in not a level of extreme crisis, but still feeling those stressors, feeling like things might be unraveling or coming out of control, and that's when our folks are really there to support with that phone support. And as you know, Peter has been working that extremely well ever since we opened that in May, and we've only been seeing that call volume increase. We had more calls to our warm line in February and January than we did in all of 2020. So it's really been picking up.
I want to talk here, Peter, in just a moment about the warm line. But first, to get your thoughts on being house manager of R&R House, what is it like?
It's fantastic. I mean, there's, all these hoops to jump through or things going on, especially like Brian was talking about the coronavirus going on. But it is great just because I know I'm able to be in a position where I can help other veterans and really get to see where they need help or, different resources are out there. I'm constantly learning of different things that are available for veterans. So it's a really unique and powerful experience.
We're discussing a new peer-run home for veterans located in Pewaukee. Peter Borecki is house manager. Brian Michael is program director for R&R House. Brian helped bring it to fruition as director of prevention services at Mental Health America of Wisconsin. What questions do you have about peer-run respite care for veterans? What do you want to know about how the house operates? What can you share with fellow veterans? Are there supports that you've turned to in difficult times? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about R&R House in Pewaukee on the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. The people behind this respite care home are veterans themselves, better connecting with lived experiences in the military, lived experiences going through mental health or substance use challenges. The R&R House is operated by Mental Health America of Wisconsin under a grant from the state DHS. Veterans, how are you managing these times? Are you finding resources are accessible and available? Join in 800-642-1234. Brian Michael is Director of Prevention Services at Mental Health America of Wisconsin, and Peter Boricki is House Manager of the Peer Run Respite Care Home for Veterans, R&R House, and they're with us for 10 more minutes. Peter, how long is a stay at the home, and how do veterans find you?
So a veteran can stay up to a week at the house. So what you would have to do is call our warm line number, which is 262-336-9540, and you would ask to stay at the house. We go through a small intake form where we get a little information on them, go over some of our policies and procedures here. We go over rules for what we do for COVID-19, go through all that. Then after that initial phone call, whatever peer answers that phone call, we talk to another peer. We would agree then, make sure we are a good fit for the vet who wants to stay here, and then we would call them back. If we feel like we're not a good fit, we just wouldn't, drop the ball. We would see what resources are out there for them and still help that veteran in any way we possibly can.
Brian, how many veterans can you accommodate, and what is the need like?
So our original plan was to open up, and we have capacity for, we have three bedrooms that are available for guest use. So every guest will get their own individual bedroom. We do have, two full bathrooms, so we can have, because it's co-ed, we do have separate bathroom facilities for males and females at the house. But during COVID, we are limiting that capacity to one. It's a two-floor house, so we have one person on each floor. So we have a capacity for a total of two guests at any time. Like Peter said, to have that week-long stay, the services they can get are really a wide range of peer support services. So when we're talking about peer support, we're not talking about getting about our staff being counselors. We're talking about our staff being providing this specialized peer support process or just the really engaging in whatever that individual veteran needs. So it's not pushing them into treatment. It's not, it's really addressing their own recovery issues, whatever they're coming to the table with. We meet them where they're at. So it may be somebody wants to come there and their medication management is throwing them off their sleep patterns, and it's disturbing their wife, it's disturbing their family. They may just be feeling stressors at home that they need to get out of that environment. And to be able to share that openly and safely with other veterans that they know or that they can be comfortable knowing are not going to judge them, are going to allow them to really express that freely.
What I'm hearing is that you do a lot of listening, I would imagine, to try to figure out what help you can provide.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's really what our folks are best in is trained into how to be not only an active listener, but to motivate the other person to be able to express themselves. When we talk about, especially when we talk about individuals and veterans, especially who might be suffering from suicidal ideation, we're not there to call a crisis line on somebody immediately. We're there to address what's underneath that issue. Oftentimes people who might be expressing those suicidal thoughts they're stuck without any other way to communicate sometimes. And the pain just grows too great that it's the only thing that they can think of that could possibly alleviate that pain. Whereas if you can talk about that and get it open there, we know that that just talking about suicide is not something that's going to increase or lead somebody to suicide.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Brian Michael and Peter Boracki about a new home in Pewaukee that's for veterans experiencing mental health and substance use challenges, other challenges as well. Brian is program director. Peter is house manager. Are you a veteran? How long did you serve? What do you think of how the state supports veterans? And what do you hope to see in terms of services and how they're provided in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. Peter, I want to ask you about the warm line and what it feels for you to answer it.
Yeah, so as Brian was talking about, we do have a warm line. It's operated 24/7, so there's always a staff member. So a veteran or their family member can call us anywhere throughout the state, give us a call, and they would leave a voice message on our voicemail. We say we'll call them back within an hour. It's usually quicker than that, but that way it gives us a chance to, if they're looking for different resources or information, gives us a little chance to find that for them right away. So then we'll give them a call, and we'll just see what that vet needs. And if they just want to talk, we'll listen. If they're looking for resources, advice, you know, we'll try to help them in any way we possibly can.
Brian, how do you see the warm line dovetail with what the R&R house can provide?
I think it really is a... It's a wonderful addition. It complements the services that and supports that somebody can get at the R&R house. It's just really one more tool in the toolbox to be able to provide some support for folks who need it, who might not know where else to go. It's also helped our veterans to continue to our veteran peers. It's helped them to kind of maintain that peer support role when they haven't been able to provide in-person services like we were hoping to when soon after receiving funding for the project. So it really it's been good that it's been able to help our staff continue to work on their peer support skills. It's going to continue to be a great resource when the rest of it is in full operation. So we haven't had our first guest yet. So we've only been open for about a month. But with all the additional information and sharing resources that we're getting, we really are well positioned to help any veteran in Wisconsin get to whatever resource, whatever connection they're trying to make. Peter and our staff have been, they work diligently to make sure that we've got an excellent resource list that can connect somebody with anything they need anywhere in Wisconsin.
Brian, that path from receiving grant funding to actually opening your doors, has that been a challenge?
It certainly has been. As we got the grant in I think March of 2019, and then our first task was just to find where we were going to locate this house. It had to be in Southeast Wisconsin, but it had to also serve statewide. So we wanted to make sure that it was in an area where somebody could still get to it easily or relatively simply from other parts of the state. That's why we chose to walk Pewaukee. It's relatively centrally located in Southeast Wisconsin. It's got easy interstate access from across the state. We've got cross state bus lines that stop through at park and rides near there that we can support people with transportation if that's an issue. But then it was really working with the community and going through a number of public hearings to address any concerns of the community. Because people really don't understand what peer support services are and what the need is for them. Veterans really need somebody who understands where they're coming from, who understands the experiences that they have. And a lot of them just can't get that in through private services, through community services. sometimes even through the VA. Not all veteran affairs providers are veterans themselves. And also I'm just a civilian, but it's been, I've been lucky enough to be working and in a role that supports veterans, whether that's through the R&R House or otherwise in the community.
Well, Brian and Peter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Brian Michael is Director of Prevention Services at Mental Health America of Wisconsin, Program Director of R&R House. Peter Boracke, Army Veteran, House Manager of the R&R House. We have more information as well as the Veteran Warm Line providing veteran peer support specialists. It's at WPR.org/mornings. Ahead this hour, we take a closer look at black bears as they begin to emerge from hibernation. We have the DNR. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about Irish culture for this St. Patrick's Day.
Irish dance has been booming for quite some time in Milwaukee, where there are multiple dance schools. If you're not familiar with this art form, Irish dancers typically keep their arms straight at their sides while their legs quickly leap, kick, and shuffle across the floor. Usually, St. Patrick's Day is a huge day for dancers as they travel across the area performing for people. While the pandemic has impacted their events this year, dancers and instructors have found a way to keep hopping and stepping in a safe way. So, to celebrate that dedication to the Irish culture, we're revisiting this story from 2014. Back then, my sister and I attended an Irish dance competition, known as a fesh, in Oconomowoc. We were Irish dancers when we were much younger, so it was super fun to watch the talented dancers, see how the reels and jigs have evolved, and to hear the live music. Take a listen.
Oh, a fesh?
No one knows what a fesh is.
A fesh is an Irish dance competition. It is craziness, but it's a competition where kids get to come and dance. We have 930 competitors. They come, they do two steps of a dance on stage. We have reels, we have jigs, we have slip jigs, hornpipes, treble jigs, sets. I am Maura Kathleen Heck, and I'm an Irish dance teacher and owner of Cashel Dunhe School of Irish Dance in Milwaukee.
It's just really fun. You get to fly, which is awesome, and I don't know, it just takes everything else that you're stressed about away, and you just get to focus on dance.
My name is Siobhan McPhail. I'm 14. I dance with Kinsella Academy of Irish Dance, and I live in Milwaukee. I think it's definitely a sport because you need to have stamina and strength and flexibility and anything that any other athlete needs.
I'm Mariana Papageorge. I'm 13 years old, and I dance for the Trinity Academy, Macon, Wisconsin, or Milwaukee. I competed in the under-14 Open Championship category, and I just finished my treble jig. This dress, it's baby blue. It's a lot of white. It has a lot of accents on it that's like a Celtic design. And it's kind of like a tennis skirt style. And then my mom added some blue crystals along the sketching of the skirt and then to the bodice.
The dresses many years ago used to be more authentic, and they would actually had Irish designs on them from this book called The Book of Kells. They've evolved into more geometric shapes and bling, as everyone calls it. And the hair, I can't... There's folklore about, you know, all back in the days of ancient Ireland, like they all curled their hair and so it bounced nicely as they, you know, were dancing down the aisles and dancing at the crossroads. When I was younger, we actually had to put the little pink curlers in our hair and sleep on them overnight, and your head against a window if you're driving to a fesh in Ohio. Oh, it was so painful. And then it took, you know, an hour to uncurl them in the morning. Now they're wigs and they take 5 minutes.
I like to put the wig on the Americans. My name is Sean Beglin, and I am the owner and director of Beglin Academy of Irish Dance. Before I finished high school, I was with Riverdance part-time, which still is a big Irish dance show. I left high school and got a call 2 days later that Riverdance wanted me full-time, and my first city was Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the Riverside Theatre. We're very lucky to be in Wisconsin. What is great about this city is that in Milwaukee we have Irish dance plus Irish music plus Irish singing plus Irish language, that we have Celtic studies. There is such a bloodline of Irish running through this area of America that you can't get away from it.
Those were the voices of Irish dancers at a FESH in Oconomowoc back in 2014 in honor of St. Patrick's Day. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now we're talking about Wisconsin's thriving black bear population, estimated by the DNR to exceed 24,000, mostly at home in the far northern reaches of our state. But since the bear population is growing, the DNR says it's not uncommon to have a sighting in the lower two-thirds of Wisconsin. Have you observed a black bear in the wild? What was that encounter, that sighting like? Do you have a trail camera? How often are you spotting bears? Join in 800-642-1234. Randy Johnson is a large carnivore specialist at the State Department of Natural Resources. Randy, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi there. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, give us a sense with these warming temperatures slowly spring around the corner. What are the bears up to?
Yeah, spring is slowly seeming to set in. You know, with that, the bears start waking up, kind of like what people do. You know, we start to come out of hibernation a little bit and take a look around. And you know, the bears can come out of their winter dens. You know, really anytime this time of year. It kind of depends on local conditions. You know, how warm temperatures are, things like that. But they're definitely starting to emerge.
Well, you know, bears, they do a brilliant job of hibernating. They don't eat, they don't drink, they don't go to the bathroom. How do they not become dehydrated during hibernation?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating thing. And frankly, there's a lot yet to be learned on just how they do it. You know, as you mentioned, there's an incredible amount of physiological changes that take place to enable them to do this. And you know, it's an interesting and ongoing piece of research. You know, one of the things that's really interesting is they maintain their ability to actually emerge from the den if they need to. You know, they're not a true hibernator, but more it's just a deep state of dormancy. But you know, every year we get reports of bear tracks. You know, more or less in the dead of winter, during a warm spell, you know, a few will come out of their den and walk around and stretch their legs a little bit. And it's really just fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, I just can't imagine like the muscle atrophy or the, you know, bone loss. I mean, these are really, really big. They can be, you know, 600 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they go into the den with an incredible amount of body fat, you know, stored up nutrients, that type of thing. And, you know, they'll lose a good third of their body weight, you know, over the course of the winter. And that's the energy that keeps them alive. But you're absolutely right. They, you know, they're able to recycle nutrients, and those types of things. You know, if a person was to lay dormant for that long, you know, we'd have all kinds of issues.
We wouldn't have
bears,
a prayer.
Bears, yeah. Not the case. No, no, it's really fascinating.
So how different is the behavior of males versus the females?
You know, from our perspective, not terribly different. You know, they both move, you know, a fair amount of distance. You know, other than the breeding season, you know, their main priority basically is to eat. And you know, they spend half the year putting food on and building up those fat reserves in order to make it through the wintertime. And so, you know, with the exception of sows with cubs, you know, most bears, that's what's driving them for the rest of the year.
Sows are the female bears and the boars are the male bears. I just want to put that out there. Okay, so you mentioned breeding and you mentioned food. And so starting with the breeding season starts like in June or late spring. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct. Yep, early summer.
Can you tell us about the litter size and what that sow is navigating as she cares for a litter?
Sure. Breeding season picks up in the spring, late or early summer. Once the female is bred, she'll continue to put on those fat reserves all summer, and then she'll actually enter the den that winter and give birth in the den to, you know, a couple real small cubs. Litter sizes can be two, all the way up to probably five at the top end. You know, three or four is real common. And they'll begin nursing right away in the den. You know, we're talking sometime in January, usually they're born. And then, you know, a couple months later, this time of year, they're emerging from the den and they're, 5 or 6 pounds, you know, pretty small, and certainly vulnerable, but, she's got a big task to keep, you know, all the cubs alive and nurse them. As spring green up occurs, more food becomes available. That helps her stay in good condition and keep those bears nursed and healthy. And they grow very quickly. During their first summer, they'll go from, like I said, pretty small size all the way up to 30 or 40 pounds pretty easily by that fall. And then they'll enter the den a second time together and continue to grow and hibernate. And then that next spring, when the bears are basically a year and a half or so, when they come out of the den the second time, and then they'll start to take off and strike out on their own, and then the cycle starts all over again.
So she really has a pretty nice long connection with those cubs.
Yeah, they stay together for about a year and a half or so, and teaching them, teaching them what's dangerous, how to find food, how to, just all the things of a bear's life. There's a lot to learn out there for sure.
And they're omnivores. What are their food habits like? What do they like to eat in Wisconsin?
Yeah, it actually kind of varies throughout the year, just depending on what's available. Right away when they come out of the den this time of year, food sources are pretty limited. And for the first few weeks that they come out, their body's undergoing all of these physiological changes. One of the big ones is their digestive system has to slowly, basically turn back on. And so the first things they start to eat when they emerge are just the green, new growth vegetation, those types of things that are very palatable, very soft to eat, helps kick everything back on. And then as spring turns into summer, we're talking about, lots of insects, bug colonies, certainly fawns, young deer or young mammals of really any kind that they can find. Very opportunistic, really. Later in the summer, berries, things like that are very common in the diet. And then as fall approaches, the acorn drop is a very significant portion of the diet. And then all along the way, too, there's the hunting activity out there provides some food sources as well through hunting baits.
Randy Johnson is a large carnivore specialist at the DNR. He's telling us about the black bear population through the seasons. What practices do you follow to stay safe from bears? We'll be talking about that. Have bears ever given you trouble while camping or hiking? Are you a hunter? What can you share about your experiences tracking bears? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Randy Johnson here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about black bears with the DNR's large carnivore specialist. Randy Johnson is here. For Wisconsin's Native American communities, black bears have a high cultural significance, treated with reverence and respect. According to the DNR's Black Bear Management Plan, the black bear is the only native large carnivore to persist continuously in Wisconsin. And Randy Johnson is with us for 10 more minutes. Let's go to Dwayne now in Wausau. Hi, Dwayne. What is your story with bears?
Oh, good morning. Well, my father-in-law lives in Nielsville, which is just north of Black River Falls. They have a house on the Black River. And anyway, he has these, he's a big bird feeder guy, and he has all these birds. One of them was bent over to the ground, and he uses really heavy duty, you know, steel conduit for poles. And he went out to bend it back up, and the feeder was only 10 yards from the wood line. And as he was bending it up, leaning over, he looked under his arm. There was the bear came out of the woods 5 feet from him.
Oh, dear.
And he grunted, the bear grunted, and it was a 600-pound bear, and they trapped him, and I think the DNR took him north. But it made, like, Good Morning America. There was on the clicker going by, it made national news and that. And
so oh, that my was goodness.
It had 8-inch prints, too, which were huge. You know, anyway, that was kind of a neat story. He got pictures of it when it went down to the river, so.
That will be some story to tell for the ages. Dwayne, thank you. Randy, what should you do? How should people respond if they encounter a bear?
Sure, yeah, it's a good, you know, spring is the perfect time to start thinking about bears again and what to do. You know, it kind of depends on the situation, of course, but best thing you can do is just remain calm and kind of assess the situation. You know, if it's something like that where it's in the backyard, you know, it's pretty clear the bear's coming for the bird feeder, that type of thing. So essentially just stay calm and try to back away in that situation. You know, let the bear know that you're a human and you don't mean it any kind of harm. You know, you can slowly talk slowly and calmly towards it and then just back away. You know, the same type of principles apply, really, if you're, say, hiking in the woods and you encounter a bear. Again, just remain calm. You can talk to it in a you know, loud, calm voice and slowly back away, and just try to avoid the situation altogether. You know, most bears really want nothing to do with people, and they're just as willing to get out of that situation as we are.
Yeah, you've called them pretty docile, but we should still treat them with an abundance of caution.
Yeah, I think respect is the right word. You know, they're certainly capable of a lot of things, and yet, you know, we just don't see very many any, you know, attacks or anything like that. They're just a very uncommon event. You know, a little bit of respect and proactivity on our end essentially helps avoid just about every negative encounter.
Let's bring in Ron in Ellsworth. Ron, hi.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
I often run into cubs when I'm steelhead fishing on the Brule, and I'm wondering what you recommend to do. I figured I didn't have to be the fastest. I just have to push one of my buddies over first, but it's a little nerve-wracking. Any tips?
Ron, thank you. Yeah, Randy, what should you do if you encounter cubs?
Yeah, you know, basically the same principles apply. You know, they're not necessarily looking to start any kind of any trouble. So again, just remain calm, kind of assess the situation, and make sure the bears have an escape route. You know, if they're coming up and you know, there's a bend in the creek or something, you know, you can kind of slowly back away and make sure that you remain safe and that they have an out. But otherwise, just make it clear that you're a human and you're not any kind of prey or anything like that. And just stay calm, talk loudly, and back away, and the situation should take care of itself.
Jerry is with us from Greendale. Jerry, have you had a cabin encounter?
Yeah, I got a couple of things. So just first, before I get to that, I was just coming back from up north in Shawamigan, Bayfield County. I did a couple of solo winter overnight camping or whatever, and I'm pretty sure I saw some bear scat, and I figured maybe they got out of their den early when we had the warm weather a few weeks ago or whatever. But I just make sure when I'm camping, I just make sure I have a clean campsite, wash my dishes away from camp. I hang my food all the time. Just don't give them any reason to come into camp or whatever. But yeah, so I don't know. It was about 10 years ago. We were staying in a cabin in Bayfield County, and my son had caught a couple of bass. He was only like 10 at the time, and I was throwing the fish guts out to the bear-proof dumpsters that were by the cabin or whatever. And all of a sudden, I saw some movement. Literally about 50 yards from me, there was a black bear obviously, and probably 400 pounds. It was a pretty big bear, and I could feel the wind on the back of my neck or whatever, and I'm like, oh, man, that bear's got like 20 yards before he gets directly downwind of me. And sure enough, right at the spot where he got downwind of me, he turned around and looked at me, and I just kind of, like you said, you know, I actually threw my fish guts behind me into the woods, and I just backed away or whatever.
Yeah.
And it kind of went on its merry way. I went in the house and made sure the kids were inside and all that kind of stuff. So,
Jerry, thank you for sharing those stories. And Randy, Jerry offering his tips on when he goes camping. What do you make of those tips?
Yeah, I think he's spot on. He's doing all the right things. You know, like I said, they're primarily driven by food. And so if a bear is able to, you know, they have an incredible sense of smell. And if they are able to come into a camp and smell food, you know, that can certainly lead to trouble. So keeping a clean camp, you know, storing that food securely away from where you're sleeping, hanging up in a tree, you know, all of those are really good practices, just to, you know, preventative measures.
Yeah. In January, the Natural Resources Board approved a roughly 22% increase in the fall bear harvest quota. Why hunt more bears?
Yeah, good question. Most of that increase is in one particular hunting zone up in northwest Wisconsin. And in this particular zone, we've seen a pretty long stretch of agricultural damage from bears. And the population in particular areas of this zone are maybe just above the cultural carrying capacity. And so one of the best things we can do there is reduce the population a little bit through regulated hunting and hopefully resolve some of those issues.
In recent decades, thousands of people apply for bear hunting licenses each year, but they don't get them due to the quota limits. How much of an issue is poaching?
Well, poaching, unfortunately, is always an issue with really any species. I don't know that it's necessarily above and beyond, more of a problem with bear per se. You know, as you mentioned, there's a limited number of hunting permits available in any given year. And that's just based on, you know, population management objectives. And so those permits are given out each year with a lottery system. And depending on which area of the state you'd like to hunt and how many permits are available for that unit, right now folks are waiting anywhere from a year or two to hunt all the way up to 12 or 13 years to hunt.
Wow.
And so it's a really popular hunt. It's a really good time, and it certainly helps us with our management objectives.
Randy, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me.
Randy Johnson is a large carnivore specialist at the DNR. Just ahead, a representative from the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence is with us as we explore strategies to identify how people feel and manage their emotions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.